Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5119, Abdul Wahab Nata, lead plaintiff in a class of Titan employees, appellant, XXX versus George W. Bush in his official capacity et al. Mr. Nata for the appellant, Ms. Braswell for appellees George W. Bush et al., and Mr. Scalia for appellees L3 Services, Inc.
All right, before we begin in this case, I would note that the rules of the court ordinarily provide that only parties and members of the bar may be seated in the council well. Because of Mr. Nata's hearing loss, we are making an accommodation for his partial disability by permitting his son to accompany him to assist him with his hearing, although we've also provided electronic assistance. The son, not a member of the bar, will not be permitted to address the court, but you may assist your father because of his disability. With that said, then, case may begin. You may approach.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case will establish precedent on whether it's illegal for U.S. government and U.S. corporation to buy slave. However, the question is not whether you believe my complaint. The case concerns whether anyone enslaving could ever state a case of action, slavery, breach of contract, or violation of employment law. My facts are so egregious that if the court dismissed my case, that no one would be able to bring this type of claims ever again. My bill further assert that the district judge abused his discretion by failing to plead sufficient fact, did not set court action with sufficient details, and did not plead fraud with particularity at par minimum. The case must be reminded with instruction that the case is be dismissed without prejudice and give a new lawyer the chance to cure drafting error. Before getting into the case of action, thought the court needs to make a decision about choice of law. You need to decide whether U.S. law, international law, Iraqi's law, or Kuwaiti's law. The defense Titan claims exemption no law applied, and it need not follow the law of any country. I condemn that choice of law is governed by just solely the law applied is the law where the fact occurred. Since the fact underpinning some causes of action occurred in different country, different law applies to different claims. At minimum, the court should constantly apply the law of at least one country. I negotiate rate of pay based open Titan promises. Titan showed numerous applicant pictures of specific building where its employees are and will be staying at. In fact, no Titan employee had or even would residence in the building, and Titan never attempted to lease the space. My conversation with Titan employee demonstrated that rather than visiting an air conditioning luxury building, Titan knew all along I would be sleeping in tent with dozen GIAs while enduring 100-degree weather and sandstorm. I also learned that Titan set a rate of bay bust open Titan promise that I would only work in Kuwait and would not be asked to enter Iraq. However, they placed me in the front line and knew I would be sent to Iraq. If this fact gives rise to cause of action for breach of contract and fraud, I also brought a tort claim of outrageous conduct precedent to Kuwaiti's law. The district court decision dismissed the entire case without mere mention of this claim. The district court concluded that Virginia law automatically makes employee at will, and thus employee can negotiate rate of pay past open false representation and then change the employee job duties. Actually, I was driven to an army base at the front line had no way to attain Kuwait City, risking death by walk more than 100 miles in sandstorm and baking. My job duties changed again when the army ordered me at gunpoint to go into Iraq. The district court come to bizarre conclusion that Weir and Bluey is not free to quit and walk home and is forced to work at gunpoint. His employment against his will, the employee is an will employee. In fact, I had unilateral contract. The employee had the right to fire me, but I had no right to quit. The Department of Justice says that lying to someone about their employment overseas to introduce them to travel abroad is a human trafficking that violates U.S. law. The district court concluded not merely that it did not violate the civil rights law by approving the government request to take me into Kuwait, although Kuwait law and U.S. law ban slavery. The district court concluded neither law applies. The court does not need to extraterritorial apply U.S. law, because the key decisions were made with the management at its headquarters in Virginia. While incompetency in Iraq, Titan headquarters sent army contracting officer in Virginia billing for my slave labor. The district court concluded, where corporation make a decision and hire employee within the United States, a complaint does not raise any factual issue about whether to extraterritorial apply. Titan asked the court to bifurcate the case by sending my claim bust on Iraq law to be tried in Iraq. Since the law of the place of occurrence governed the Titan last worked in Iraq, but I was fired in Germany. Either Iraq employment law should govern the termination, and this foreign law forbid firing an injured work. If U.S. law applied, I have a claim under the Family Leave Act, but the law of at least one country should apply. The Supreme Court decision in Pepper Aircraft rules that federal court should hear a case occurring abroad if the forum proposed by defendants does not provide the blunt of a fair remedy. The complaints explain great detail the fact that Article 17 of the Collision Provision Authority and Treaty between the U.S. and Iraq state that Iraq court lack authority to serve legal process on contract on their employee, the U.S. government or government employee. And state Article 17 state that U.S. contractor must obey Iraq law, but any claims against contractor under Iraq law must be brought in the contract's home nation, where the Iraqi law claims transferred to Iraq and Iraq court should lack an ability to issue summon, and the case would instantly be dismissed. Pepper Aircraft provided Blantov has the right to bring his case in U.S. because the Iraq court offered him two possibility of relief. The district court dismissed the army as a different pest solely in the assertion that army enjoys sovereignty immunity from any claim. I was drafted to the army as an E-4, but the army never paid me a dime. The court ruled the army enjoys sovereignty immunity from claims for lack pay, even though it is clear the Military Pay Act guarantees soldiers a cause of action since I sought less than $10,000 in damage. I had the right to file Tracker Act claim in district court while serving on D.C. Circuit Justice Ginsburg authored an opinion ruling that back pay is an equitable remedy and that sovereign immunity does not apply. The federal government provides a host of privileged to disabled service numbers such as medical care and federal hiring. Pursuant to the Administration Procedure Act and the Clarity Adjustment Act, I asked the court to rule that I was disabled veteran. However, the district court ruled the government is immune from claim seeking injunctive declaratory relief. In ruling on motion to dismiss the fact alleged sufficient to create a plausible claim that I serve in military as an E4. In summary, after being drafted at gunpoint, I become permanently disabled as a result of combat injuries sustained in Iraq. I appreciate the chance to address you, and I am confident you will rule this egregious fact entitled me to some relief. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the federal appellees.
May it please the court. This appeal presents two narrow issues with respect to the federal appellees. The first is whether the district court properly dismissed the appellant's claims under Bivens against six unknown federal employees as barred by the statute of limitations. And second, whether the district court properly denied appellee's request to add Secretary of the Army Francis Harvey as a new defendant. With respect to the Bivens claims, it is clear that the district court properly dismissed those claims on the statute of limitations grounds. Mr. Nataz's claims arose in 2003. He filed this lawsuit in April of 2006. His claims that he was held against his will amount essentially to a false imprisonment claim, which actually under the District of Columbia law is subject to a 1-year statute of limitations. But even given the generous 3-year statute of limitations that the district court applied, his claims would still be barred by the statute of limitations because as of March of 2008, when the district court issued its decision dismissing those claims, the unknown federal employees had not been identified. There had been no case brought against them. So even under the 3-year statute of limitations, his claims would be barred against those individuals. With respect to his claims against Secretary of the Army Harvey, to the extent that he was seeking any claims for monetary damages, those would be barred by sovereign immunity under this court's decision in Clark. And to the extent he was seeking any non-monetary claims, his claims would be barred by Rule 8 and the Supreme Court's decision in Ashcroft versus Iqbal because he does not plead any specific claims against Secretary Harvey, which is actually not surprising since Secretary Harvey did not become Secretary of the Army until March of 2004. So the complaint raises no specific claims against Secretary Harvey that would state a claim, and the district court properly dismissed those claims as well. If the court has no questions.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the other appellees.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Scalia of Greenberg Traurig on behalf of Appellee L3 Services, Inc. May it please the court. I'd like to think that we've done an adequate job in our briefing before this court setting forth our position and our arguments, and I won't rehash them this morning except as necessary to answer any questions that Your Honors may have. What I would like to do is just spend just a minute or so trying to put this our positions and our arguments in a framework that I perhaps haven't done a good enough job in my briefs on. The issue before the court with respect to L3 Services, Inc. is whether the district court properly granted L3's motion to dismiss the amended complaint. Suffice it to say, we believe that the district court did act appropriately. With all due respect to Mr. Natal, we believe that the complaint, which the original complaint was 28 pages long. The amended complaint that was dismissed by the district court grew to 88 pages in length, and if anything was even more incomprehensible than the original pleading. I think it's exactly the kind of pleading that the Supreme Court had in mind in its recent decisions in Twombly and
assume that we didn't have Twombly and Iqbal. Could you still win your case?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that this particular pleading is would be appropriately dismissed even prior to Iqbal or Twombly. It just it just doesn't, in my view, come even close to stating a claim, any claim, with enough specific factual allegations and enough specific references to specific laws that would put L3 on sufficient notice as to what it's being sued about and to enable L3 to defend itself. And there really, I think you can put the deficiencies.
Why isn't it clear that he's brought a breach of oral, the oral promises?
I think
that's
that,
clear that he's brought that, whether that's got merit or not.
Right, Your Honor, I think he's got, and we've briefed this issue, I think he's got a few problems with a breach of an oral contract. First of all, there was an offer letter that he identifies in his own pleading that clearly identifies his employment as one of at will. As an at-will employee, therefore, he couldn't have relied on any sort of oral representations that would have changed that relationship.
That's true if they conflicted, but if you are an at-will employee and you're told you're going to get, $10,000 a month and you get $10 a month, you're told outside of the written at-will contract that says it's at-will, you've got a cause of action, don't you?
Well, I if you plead it sufficiently, Your Honor, and I don't think that's the case here. He has failed to identify, who made the promises, when they were made, the context in which they were made, and without that, I don't think he states a claim.
Even under notice pleading.
Even under notice pleading. But his deficiencies, I think, can really be lumped into three main categories or buckets. And the first, and some of the counts actually fall into several or all three of the buckets. And I think the first bucket he's set forth some counts that simply don't identify what law he's suing L3 under. The second bucket is those counts where he has identified a law, but it's clear based on the law itself, or at least the authority interpreting the law, that there's simply no private right of action for a private individual to bring a civil action against a private entity such as L3. And then the third and perhaps the largest bucket is the Twombly bucket, and even the pre-Twombly bucket, that he simply, although his complaint is extremely long, it is really rife with general factual allegations and conclusions of law, almost completely devoid of any specific allegations that would be sufficient to state a cause of action.
I don't agree. His allegation is he was promised housing and meals, and he says he was promised a specific type of housing, and of course the letter you all sent didn't speak to that. I got that from the complaint. What's confusing about that, or what's vague about that?
Well, I think that's certainly, and perhaps one of the few examples where he does set forth some specific allegations. Those allegations, although specific in nature, for the reasons we've set forth in our brief to this court, fail to state a cause of action for breach of contract because there was an offer letter that clearly stated that he was an at-will employee. He essentially concedes the existence of that offer letter and that employment relationship. So
excuse me, go ahead.
I was going to say, what's your position on the enforceability of an oral contract that does not conflict with or that supplements a written contract? And I know you're saying he doesn't have any contract, but he has at least at-will employment.
Well, I think we've cited this authority in our brief, Your Honor. I think the law is clear when there is an at-will relationship and the employer has the right to terminate the employment at will for any reason or no reason at all, as long as it's not an unlawful one, that it has the lesser right to, for example, demote an employee, for example, reduce the employee's salary or duties, to deny training, to deny housing that may have been promised before, and it doesn't give rise to a breach of contract or, for that matter, any other legal claim.
At will does not preclude the possibility of contractual terms between an employer and an employee, does it? I mean, you may be working at will, but still, if your employer has promised to pay you $1,000 a week and you get to the end of the first week and they pay you $500, they've breached a contract, haven't they? Most employees are at will in Virginia. This contract allegedly was made in Virginia. That doesn't mean they don't have agreements as to the terms of employment, does it?
With respect, Your Honor, if it's an at-will relationship and the employer has the unilateral right to terminate the employee for any reason or no reason, it has the lesser right to unilaterally demote the employee or reduce his pay without
the lesser included right. The existence of an at-will relationship does not, to my knowledge, imply a unilaterally amendable contract. If the employer in an at-will relationship, and most relationships in Virginia are at-will,
correct,
says, I'm going to pay you X dollars a week, then you have, don't you have, an enforceable contract for X dollars a week?
I would submit, Your Honor, that you do not.
Do you think you think an employer says, all right, you come to work for me. We both know it's at will. I'm going to pay you $1,000 if you work for me this week. And the employee comes in and you give him $500, you don't think he's got a right to sue for the other $500?
I do not, Your Honor, and I do not think believe
that. Are you depending upon that proposition to win this case?
I think this is a narrow issue in this case, Your Honor, but I believe that the case law is well settled, and we've cited in our brief.
I don't think there are any cases that support the proposition you just made.
The employee's,
if you have one, you tell me.
The employee's right is to the employee's remedy is to quit, is to resign.
Even if the employer has not paid him what the employer has promised to pay him?
Well, if it's an at-will employment relationship, it's
at will means that it's terminable at will.
That's right,
what it means.
Your Honor, with respect, it also means that if you can terminate the employment relationship at will, which is the ultimate right, you can take the lesser steps of demotion, reduction of duties, reduction of pay.
You can do that by saying at the end of that first week, from now on, I'm only going to pay you $500. Then the employee has the right to leave. That does not imply that there is a right to welch on what you promised to pay the employee for what he's already part performed. You cannot defend that proposition.
Your Honor,
Edwards would say, you can't come in here and say that.
Your Honors, I apologize. I apologize to the court because I understood you to be asking me about prospective changes in the terms and conditions of the employment relationship.
That's not what the lawsuit's about.
And I will, just to clarify my position, I am not taking the position that that you can retroactively just say, you know, for the 2 weeks that we said we were going to pay you $1,000, we're only going to pay you half of that. I will concede that you cannot do that. That, you know, that is certainly a wage claim, a state law wage claim, and it may also be a breach of contract.
It isn't that it may also be a breach of contract. Do they still teach contracts in law school?
Your Honor, I've been out too long to answer that question. But
it doesn't seem long at all from my viewpoint, counsel. Do you also have a statute of limitations defense on any claim here?
We have several.
Did you raise them below?
I'm sorry?
Did you raise them below?
We have a statute of limitations defense with respect to other claims. I'm not sure that we've raised one with the contract claim.
Okay. Unless there are other questions from my colleagues, the case will be submitted. You can call the next case.
Thank you, Your Honors.